Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Wendy Weiser of the Brennan Center for Justice, who discusses new election laws being enacted by GOP governors in various states designed to suppress voter participation for partisan political advantage. Activist Junior Walk, who talks about his decision to participate in a nonviolent civil disobedience tree-sitting action protesting mountaintop removal coal mining at West Virginia's Coal River Mountain. And Arjun Makajani of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research, who provides an update on the continuing nuclear disaster at Fukushima, Japan, and the response by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to safeguard U.S. nuclear power plants. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
During a United Nations debate held on July 20th, Russia and its allies successfully watered down a Security Council resolution on climate change and political instability, reports The Guardian newspaper. Russia also blocked a plan to establish a new peacekeeping force to intervene in climate-induced conflicts. Germany, which chaired the UN Security Council in July, claims climate change has already contributed to droughts in Africa that have led to conflicts in Darfur, the Western Sudan, and Somalia. United States Ambassador to the UN, Susan Rice, called the Security Council deadlock on climate change and security risk pathetic, short-sighted, and a dereliction of duty. But Russian Ambassador Alexander Penkin expressed his skepticism of efforts by European countries to put climate change on the Security Council agenda. Such a move, Penkin insisted, would only further politicize the climate change debate and increase disagreements among countries. The changing amount of glacial melt could also lead to more disputes over water resources in Central Asia, Tibet, the Hindu Kush region in India, the Mekong Delta in Southeast Asia, and the Tigris and Euphrates rivers bordering Iraq, Syria, and Turkey. The UN Environment Program has identified 10 peacekeeping missions that cost the international community over $35 billion, where a conflict was significantly caused by disputes over natural resources. The state of Vermont has won the first round in its legal fight to close the Vermont Yankee nuclear power plant. U.S. Federal District Court Judge J. Garvin Murtha rejected a motion by the plant's operator, Entergy, to impose an injunction against closing the plant until the court case is resolved. In February 2010, the Vermont State Senate voted overwhelmingly to let Vermont Yankee close after its operating license expires in 2012. Yet the Nuclear Regulatory Commission recently moved to extend the nuclear plant's license for another 20 years. The NRC decision occurred only days after the disaster at Japan's Fukushima nuclear complex began. Vermont Yankee and Fukushima's nuclear power reactors are of the same design. The Christian Science Monitor reports legal observers expect the case to be appealed all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. In 1983, the High Court ruled that states have the right to regulate aspects of nuclear power. With the court order, Entergy must now decide if it wants to order a new shipment of nuclear fuel at a cost of $65 million. It could risk losing that investment if the state closes the nuclear plant as planned in March 2012. With a weak economy persisting across Europe and the United States, all-time high gold prices have spiked to over $1,600 an ounce. According to the Christian Science Monitor, the price of gold has tripled since 2005, largely driven by new demand from India and China. Gold has traditionally been seen as a safe haven by investors during times of economic uncertainty. Americans are once again venturing to California to pan for gold, not far from the site of the 1848 gold rush. Klondike Mike LaBox, who runs a gold prospecting tour, observed, "We had people literally selling their farms and cows showing up at our camps. I told them to get a job. You can't support yourself panning for gold." In booming China, where the trade of gold bullion was legalized in 2001, gold coins and ingots have become the preferred method of buying favors from state and municipal officials. Despite its glamour, gold mining carries a heavy environmental cost. Extracting an ounce of gold creates over 30 tons of waste, more than any other metal. In 2000, a gold mine in Romania leaked huge amounts of cyanide into waterways, which spilled into the Black Sea, killing thousands of fish. Today, illegal gold mining in Peru is threatening the Tambopata National Reserve, which is home to 7% of the world's bird species. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
As President Obama and Congress engage in a sometimes nasty public debate on negotiating a legislative resolution to raising the nation's debt ceiling before an August 2nd deadline, the politics of the 2012 election is never far away. Competing policies on addressing national debt, the solvency of Social Security and Medicare, and future tax rates will all be important issues in the presidential and congressional election in November 2012. But as the U.S. corporate media focus their attention on the Democratic-Republican Party debate in Washington, the election campaign has taken an ugly turn in state capitals around the country. Republican governors working with GOP-controlled state legislatures have passed dozens of bills designed to place obstacles in the path of minority, senior citizen, and student voters to cast ballots in the upcoming election. Republican legislative measures, which many critics charge have been enacted to gain partisan political advantage over Democrats, include severe limitations placed on voter registration drives, restrictive photo ID laws, curtailing opportunities for early and absentee voting, and efforts to disenfranchise college students. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Wendy Weiser, director of the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law. She discusses new election voting laws being implemented in various states, their impact on election participation, and efforts underway to challenge these tactics to suppress the vote.
We have seen a real significant assault on voting across the country, the most significant assault we've seen in decades. We are seeing a range of bills and laws passing across the country that make it a lot harder for people to register and to vote and to participate effectively in our democracy. They come in all different sorts of flavors. One common is very restrictive voter identification requirements, or requirements that people prove their citizenship with certain documentation. There are also laws that make it harder to register, that cut back on early voting, that add certain technical barriers to voting or to having your vote counted. It's been a real broad-based attack on voting, and it will have a significant impact, we believe, in 2012 and going forward.
Can you talk maybe about some of the individual states that many of us have been reading about in Wisconsin, Florida, Georgia, and some others?
Yeah, sure. I'm happy to do so. One, Florida is a really good example of a state that has just passed a very restrictive set of measures on voting. Florida passed a significant bill that will make it much more difficult for individuals to register to vote. They have essentially made it impossible for voter registration drives to operate in that state, and they've also made it more difficult for registered voters to change their address and still be able to vote a ballot that will count. That's very significant. Both of those are very significant because the rate of voter registration in Florida has been declining significantly over the past number of years, and so this, we're going to expect to see it decline even further. They've also reduced early voting. That was a very significant development and positive development in Florida law that many minority voters, for example, took advantage of in 2008 and in 2010, and now the number of early voting days has been cut back significantly. So that's one example of a set of restrictions that passed. Wisconsin passed an extraordinarily restrictive voter ID law, now perhaps the most restrictive law in the country, that has a very limited set of photo identifications that can be used for voting and doesn't have a lot of options for people who don't have those IDs on them on election day to be able to cast a ballot that will count, and doesn't make it very easy for people to get those IDs if they don't have them.
Wendy, the rationale for many of these laws being implemented across the country by these Republican governors and the Republican-dominated state legislatures, the rationale is that there's a lot of voter fraud out there, that many people are voting fraudulently under false names, that somehow that this fraud is changing the results of elections, so therefore these state governments have to crack down. Is there any evidence that there is a plague, a virtual kind of outbreak of voter fraud around the country that rationalizes this action?
Absolutely not. In fact, to the contrary. Now, to be clear, there are election irregularities and there is some fraud in election, but it is not the kind of fraud that these laws are targeting. Study after study show that individuals showing up at the polls and fraudulently voting and trying to be someone else is just something that does not happen. There have been substantial investigations of elections in a number of states, statewide investigations in Washington State and Ohio, for example, that have shown that the rate of in-person voter fraud is really infinitesimal, that you are much more likely to get struck by lightning than to have an American try and commit this kind of in-person voter fraud.
Wendy, what are the ways in which civil liberties advocates and people who are trying to make it possible for as many citizens to vote as possible who are opposed to these laws, what tools do they have to challenge these state laws under federal jurisdiction, the courts, or however it would be effective? What can they do?
The Department of Justice or federal courts applying the Voting Rights Act of 1965 might play a role. And in a number of states, largely in the South, but not exclusively, that are covered by the Voting Rights Act, the Department of Justice or a federal court has to pre-clear the law. It cannot go into effect until either Department of Justice or a court decides that the law is not going to have a negative impact on minorities and their ability to participate in elections and elect their representatives of their choice. And a number of states that have passed these laws are subject to that requirement, and right now some of these have already been submitted to the Department of Justice for consideration, like Florida, like North Carolina will be as well, Texas. That's one tool that is available to people in the courts. Certainly the U.S. Constitution and our state constitutions are another tools. We do have a right to vote that is protected under the Constitution of every state and of the United States as well, and if this unduly restricts the right to vote and if people cannot participate effectively, then they might be able to use the federal courts or the state courts as well. People should actually take this assault on voting rights as a rallying cry and say, we will not be discouraged. We will just work that much harder to participate and to mobilize our fellow community members to participate so that nobody takes away our right to vote and our ability to elect the representatives of our choice. So we certainly hope that your listeners take away that message and get energized by this.
That was Wendy Weiser, director of the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law. Learn more about legislation designed to suppress the vote at our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On July 20th, two activists climbed 80 feet high in two trees adjacent to an active mountaintop removal coal mining site at Coal River Mountain in southern West Virginia. The site was owned by Massey Energy, the largest mountaintop removal coal miner in Appalachia, which also owns the underground Upper Big Branch mine, where 29 miners were killed last year. The company was sold this spring to Alpha Natural Resources, which is continuing the same operations. Junior Walk is a 21-year-old native of southern West Virginia who provided support to Catherine Ann McDougall, one of the tree sitters, along with Eli Shule, who served as the support person for the second tree sitter, Bex Collins. The two support persons were arrested by state police on the first day of the tree sit protest and charged with trespassing. The tree sit continues as of production time. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Walk about his decision to participate in this nonviolent civil disobedience action, which is one of a growing number of similar protests organized to stop mountaintop removal coal mining. He also discusses the goals of the sponsoring organization, Radical Action for Mountain People's Survival, or RAMPS, campaign. The group's acronym, RAMPS, references the wild onion that local residents used to harvest on the Appalachian Mountains, now threatened or destroyed by mountaintop removal coal mining.
After I graduated high school, I tried to go to college, but I was the first person in my family to graduate high school, let alone, you know, want to go to college. So I was stuck here because I didn't really have the means to go. And I did what everybody else does whenever they are stuck here. I went to work for Massey, right alongside my dad at the Elk Run prep plant, and he still works there today. That was just a terrible experience. I only worked there for about 6 months. Some days they would just have me, you know, cutting the grass or what have you. Some days I'd be walking the belt line or things like that. But it was just like I always felt like that lump of coal was worth more than what my life was worth. And I should prioritize the production over anything else. And I just couldn't live like that. So after that, I went around from job to job for a while until a friend of the family offered me a job as a security guard on a strip mine. And I took it, you know. I was like, oh, I get to sit around for 12 hours a night and make money. But when I got up there and I seen that, and I was in the middle of that, and I seen the way they were doing, and, you know, I seen them destroying that mountain. And I knew the people down below that mountain were going through the same stuff that I was going through when I was a kid, you know. Poison water, you know, poison air. You can't even go up on the mountain anymore, mostly because it don't exist, but also because there's gates up, you know, everywhere. You know, people don't have access to the places where their, you know, parents and grandparents, you know, hunted or gathered herbs and things like that. So I came to Cold River Mountain Watch, and I'd known Judy Bonds ever since I was a kid. She used to work at the store with my grandma, and I asked her how I could help, how I could plug in, how I could do something to alleviate my conscience, because I just felt like the most terrible human being making money off of what was going on and what was happening to those people below that mountain. I started, like, writing anonymously for the newsletter and, you know, things that I didn't have to put my name or face out there. And eventually Judy offered me a job. Well, it was Judy and Vernon, the two folks. Well, Vernon's still director of Cold River Mountain Watch, along with Debbie Jarrell, and Judy Bonds passed away this past January of lung cancer. Ever since then, I've been here doing this sort of work. And it's frustrating going up against Goliath, that's the coal industry, that controls this state completely. You know, our regulatory agencies won't help us because they're funded by the state, who is funded by the coal industry. And it's everything. Every place you can think of to turn to in the state government here is just, they won't listen to you if you say one ill word about coal or any sort of natural resource extraction. So I decided on my own that legal channels weren't enough to put a stop to what's going on here. That's why I decided to take this stand and try and do whatever I could to protect the community that I come from.
Exactly where are the two tree sitters?
They are in Beetree Holler, which is right next to the Beetree surface mine permit, and where active blasting has been going on. By sitting there as close as they are to the Beetree permit, they cannot blast on a certain section of the permit that they were working on before, and they can't get the coal that was right there.
And Junior Walk, what was your role, and why were you arrested?
I was direct support, which means that I helped get the tree sit up in the trees. You know, I helped haul the water and things and the platform up. And then we waited around for about 4 or 5 hours. They couldn't find us, and they had the entire site shut down for 5 hours. They didn't know where we were, and we eventually seen a helicopter buzzing us overhead, so we figured that that was the police, so we came out, me and Eli did, and it actually turns out it was Alpha executives that were actually flying dangerously close to the tree sitters.
I guess how long they stay up there depends on how long those supplies last, and especially on how aggressive the police are in getting them down. What is RAMP's campaign's goal in doing these kinds of actions?
Well, there are quite a few goals, actually. I mean, the first one we're accomplishing right now, they're not blasting where they were blasting before. And that's really the main goal. The other goal is to raise awareness about this issue on a national scale. And I think that we're accomplishing that quite well. And then the other goal is to inspire the people that live around here and make them remember that they have a choice. You know, they don't have to be afraid of the coal industry. They can stand up and tell the industry that they're not going to take the abuse anymore. And I've had, you know, numerous phone calls from people that knew me while I was growing up, you know, older people and things like that, that have told me if they were able-bodied or if they didn't have to live in fear of losing their only means of income, then they would have been right there with us.
That was Junior Walk, a local West Virginia activist acting in support of a tree-sitting protest at Coal River Mountain. Learn more about the opponents of mountaintop removal coal mining at our website at btlonline.org. Although the multiple failure of nuclear power reactors at Fukushima, Japan, is one of the worst nuclear accidents in world history, corporate press outlets have cut back on most of their coverage of the disaster triggered by the March 11th earthquake and tsunami. Since the early days of the crisis, three of Fukushima's six nuclear reactors melted down and spewed radioactivity into the atmosphere and nearby ocean. Although a 20-kilometer or 12-mile exclusion zone was imposed around the stricken plant, many radioactive hotspots outside the zone have caused the local population to be concerned about the negative health effects, especially among children. In response, Fukushima's prefectural government will conduct thyroid cancer testing on all residents who were 18 years old or under when the accident occurred, and repeat examinations every 2 years until age 20, and then every 5 years. The affected population is estimated to be 360,000. Radioactive contamination of Japan's food supply, including beef, produce, and seafood, has moved the government to launch a plan to purchase and destroy all tainted beef and other tainted food items. Medical research has found prolonged exposure to radiation in the air, ground, and food can cause leukemia and other cancers. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Arjun Makajani, president of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research, who provides an update on the continuing nuclear disaster at Fukushima, Japan, and the response thus far by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to safeguard America's nuclear power plants.
Mostly it is fairly static in that there are low-level releases still going on. The very serious releases of the first few weeks, you know, have diminished considerably. The temporary cooling arrangements are going on. In the last few weeks, you know, it has become clear that the accident in terms of the meltdown was more serious. And I think they should have known initially that it was more serious. At least some people had said that, in the sense that in reactor number one, for instance, there had been a complete meltdown and the fuel seems to have melted through the reactor vessel. So the reactor vessel does not have integrity anymore. And that might have happened in the other two reactors as well. You know, they have plans to put a sort of a polyethylene plastic dome over building one and maybe later on the other buildings, a damaged building, so as to try to contain the releases and filter the air. But it's very unclear how they're going to decommission this. Now, so far as the inhabitants are concerned that have been evacuated, they don't know when they're going to be able to go home. There are a lot of hot spots that are contaminated, and the hot spots actually extend in irregular patterns from the site quite a bit farther away than the zone in which people had been said, you know, stay indoors. And I'm afraid, you know, looking at the picture today, more than 4 months, nearly 4.5 months after the start of the accident, I think there's been a pretty serious mismanagement of the whole evacuation, radiation protection situation. Of course, it's not like Chernobyl. Chernobyl was, you know, there was a cover-up and people were allowed to be irradiated at very severe levels for quite some time before they were evacuated. That was not the case here. So I think the population's been better protected. But that's a cold comfort. Chernobyl was extremely bad in terms of public protection.
Well, Arjun Makajani, What are your biggest concerns concerning this cleanup by the government of Japan and TEPCO, the Tokyo Electric Power Company? Are they doing things properly in a way that you think will ensure the safety of the people of Japan, given that there have been a lot of protests as well as concerns about the limits of exposure, especially for children in the area around Fukushima Prefecture? What are your top concerns there?
Well, my top concerns are really, as you said, regarding the safety of the public and the public being able to resume something resembling a normal life and the proper monitoring of the public. Fortunately, the idea that children could be exposed to the same level as workers just by going to school and playing, this idea has been discarded, and they're going to try to clean up the schools and map the hot spots. That's going to take some time. I'm very concerned that this site could become a nuclear dump, in a very seismic zone right on the Pacific Ocean with enormous amounts of radioactivity. I don't see that they've put forward a credible plan to actually decommission the site. There was a lot of talk of pouring concrete and, you know, burying the waste there. But you cannot leave this material on the seashore in a seismic zone. It would be very dangerous for the future to do that. And I have not seen any credible plan to decommission this site.
Arjun Makhijani, as we close out here, your organization has given some thought to the lessons that we need to learn from Fukushima about the safety of nuclear power plants here in the United States. And as you look at the status of our nuclear power industry and the plants, the reactors, what do you come away with as the most important thing we need to do immediately, the government and the nuclear power utilities? What do they need to do to ensure that we don't have a horrendous accident like Fukushima?
Well, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission had a 90-day task force evaluating Fukushima. They've come out with their interim report, the 90-day report. And there are some very good things in that report. I think it's quite inadequate in most ways, but there are some very good things in it. They call the existing regulations a patchwork in some respects, and I think we need to replace that patchwork. For example, some plants have had seismic evaluations recently and some not. We're still allowing companies to do self-assessments. We need to stop a lot of laxness in regard to regulation, even though we're living in an anti-regulatory climate. We also need to stop relicensing existing plants, stop making the decisions to extend their lives until the lessons of Fukushima are fully clear and we understand about what needs to be done regarding safety. We need to make sure we don't have a tragedy like Fukushima. And the other thing we need to do, to begin to do immediately, is to take spent fuel out of the pools and put it in dry storage. The older spent fuel that's more than 3 to 5 years old can be taken out of the pool and put into much safer dry storage, and we need to begin that. But the NRC has not ordered these things. The chairman of the NRC wanted to implement the recommendations to change the regulations within 90 days, but the majority of the NRC is not for it.
That was Arjun Makhijani, president of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research. Find links to more information about the Fukushima nuclear disaster on our website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut 06611. Visit our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.